Well, good morning, everyone. It's an honor to be with you here at Faith today. My name is Pastor Matt Ewart, and as Pastor Dan said, not only did we grow up together, but we're still good friends, I think. I'll actually tell a little story about something that we did a while ago, but I didn't even warn him. I'm going to tell you. We'll save that for the end of the message, though. Pastor Dan had asked me if there was a topic or a message I wanted to share today, and something that I dug into recently, which I know challenged me in a lot of ways, I thought would be number one, good for me to work through again. So you're kind of my therapist today because we're going to work through this. But also, I think good for us because what we're going to talk about is something unique that the Bible says that we might not think about very often. So you probably know that throughout the Bible, there's hundreds of places where it gives us the command or the encouragement, do not be afraid or do not fear. But there's also about 200 places in the Bible where it says, fear God. And maybe a common question is, what does it mean to fear God, and how do I know if I'm doing it? And so simply what I want to do today is talk about that concept. What does it mean to have a healthy fear of God? And specifically, how can we make sure that the fear of God isn't in competition with some other fears that you might have in life? To start, I want to tell you a quick story. So I'm curious, how many of you have been to New York City before? Been to New York. Wow, a large number. Okay. So you kind of know what this, not all of you, which is, it's just cool. This last August, my family and I, my three kids and my wife, Amy, we went on a kind of a touristy trip out in the eastern coast. And one of the places that we visited was New York City. And so since there were a bunch of places we wanted to see in the city, and because this guy didn't want to drive everywhere in New York City, we knew we needed to figure out how to make use of the subway system. And so here's a little bit of a more defined question. How many of you have used the subway system in New York City? So not quite as many, but still a good number. And so if you haven't ridden it in recent years, it's actually pretty simple to use the subway system. They have these little check-in kiosks with a little pad on the side, and then once you check in, make the payment, you just turn the turnstile, and it lets you into the subway area. And there's an easy way to make it work, so you either get a prepaid card, or you can use, these days, use Google Pay or Apple Pay just straight from your phone. And so since we're so technologically savvy, we decided let's just use our phones, and so that's what we did. First day, we were going around New York City. Everything worked without any issues at all. So we both had Google Pay on our phone. We beep. You know, it's so satisfying. Like when you hold up your payment and it tells you you're good, it's beep. It's like, oh, that just sounds good. I'm sure they spent way too much money developing that beep sound. But it gives you a little beep, and so family of five beeps. Beep, 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 beep. We all get checked in. We get in the subway. We go the wrong way the first day, but we figured out we have to go back and check in again. But first day, we make use of the subways. Second day, we want to go out and see the Statue of Liberty and some other things around New York City. And so once again, we get on the subway. Everything's great. We come back. We need to go back to the hotel. And so I'm so confident at this point, I tell my wife, Amy, don't worry about it. We'll just use my phone because we're good to go. We've done this now. And so I check in, kid one, beep, kid two, beep, kid three, beep, Amy, beep. Me, no beep. There's no beep. And so I'm looking at my phone, looking at the kiosk, like, why is it not letting me through? And I push the turnstile. It's not letting me on to see my family. And so there's this moment of panic. Because I've heard news stories of what happens in the New York City subways. And now I am separated from my wife and three kids. And I have no way to get to them apart from jumping over this turnstile. And so I'm trying to figure this out, and I look over and I see off to my right, there's this attendant about 25 feet away sitting behind a counter. And I'm looking at her in desperation with these wide eyes, like, can you help me? But she's not even looking at me. She's intentionally looking like away from me. Like her eyes are just locked away from me, and I'm trying to get her attention, but she's not looking. And so I look back at my wife, Amy, and she had this look, like the wide eyes. And if you're married, you know that look means figure this out. And so I swipe to a different credit card. I try that. It still doesn't work. No beeps. And I'm getting desperate. And so I look back at the lady. She's still looking in the same spot, like away. She's intentionally looking away from me. And so I look back at my wife one more time, and she looks like Dwayne The Rock Johnson, like with his eyebrows raised up. Like she, and I know, like, I'm starting to panic. And so I had to make a decision. On the one hand, I was afraid to leave my wife and kids. On the other hand, I was afraid, I'm a tourist, I don't know, do they arrest people for jumping the turnstile? Do you get a big fine? Like, what's the deal here? I was stuck between two fears. And I will acknowledge to you today that my greater fear was for my wife and kids, and I ended up jumping the turnstile. Not proud of the moment, but in the moment of panic, that's what I decided to do. And that's what all of us do every day. We have these fears that we're in tension with. And maybe the first thing I wanted to focus on today is that we all arrange our life around our greatest fears. Now, this isn't like a spider fear or a snake fear, and that's understandable. You're afraid of something, so you stay away from it. But there's a different kind of fear that actually makes you arrange your life in certain ways. I think of middle school, high school students. And by the way, the example I'm about to give applies to adults too. It's just that we're better at hiding the fears. A common fear for middle school and high school students is not having friends. Or more specifically, standing out because you stand alone. That's a common fear for middle school, high school students. And being a dad myself, I've seen what kids do to work around their fear, to wait in a certain area, and to go out of their way so that they can walk with someone or just not be alone. And I've also seen the fear of going to an event where it might be the best event ever, but if there's no friends going, forget about it, because they're living their life around that fear of standing out because they stand alone. There's also some conflicting fears sometimes, like a fear of getting in trouble, a fear of being punished because you're breaking the rules. At least I hope most high school students have that fear. There's this fear of making sure you live your life in such a way that you keep the rules so that you don't get called to the principal's office or so that you don't get in trouble. But there's some rare times in life, hopefully rare, where those two fears are competing. Because sometimes it might be that in order to be cool or to get attention, you need to break some rules. And let's be honest, we don't always pick the right fear to be the greatest fear. Have you seen that in your life? Where you know that your fear of something is arranging your life in such a way that it doesn't make sense. You know that a certain fear of something is drawing you away from your attention toward God or your love toward God. So why is it that we often choose an unhealthy fear to arrange our life around rather than direct our healthy fear towards a fear of God himself? Well, let's look at two reasons why we so easily gravitate towards unhealthy fears to arrange our lives around. And the first example is going to come from Genesis chapter 4. In Genesis 4, we see the account of Cain and Abel. And quite often you might think of this account as, oh yeah, this is the story of the first murder in the Bible, which it is, the account of the first murder. But actually, it was a murder that was provoked by fear. Long story short, Cain and his brother Abel were both offering sacrifices to God. But what we know is that Abel's offering was accepted while Cain's was not. And so what fear began to take root in Cain's heart? And you can only imagine, if you're meeting with your group this week, you can actually talk about that as one of the discussion questions. What fears do you think came to mind as his sacrifice was not approved of? Maybe he felt unworthy. Maybe he felt he would never measure up to his sibling. There were fears that were growing in his heart. And rather than taking those fears to God, or taking those fears in repenting to God, instead, he turned someplace else. God, knowing what Cain was planning to do, said this. He said, if you do what is right, will you not be, here's the key word, accepted. Cain's fear was that he was not going to be accepted. But God says, if you do what's right, won't you be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, be aware, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you. But you must rule over it. In other words, Cain, I know that there's a fear that maybe you're not acceptable. Don't turn to sin for the solution of that fear. Sin is promising you an answer that if your brother is taken out, you'll be acceptable, but that's not the solution that we need. The principle that we get from this is that sin applies an illegitimate solution to a very legitimate fear. There's different ways this can come across in your life. Sometimes if you feel like someone else's success is threatening your value, well, then maybe you turn to gossip or you turn to undermining them in an effort to fix the problem of your fear. We see Cain's solution was a permanent one, but quite often we can just harbor maybe ill will. We can harbor these attitudes of wanting to get even with someone, and we feel as long as we let that anger sit there, then we're working on a solution. But what God wanted Cain to know is what your Father in heaven wants you and me to know too. Sin is not a solution to deal with our fears. In fact, sin wants to have you. It will own you. And as soon as you step into that path for finding a solution to your fear, you find yourself in a loop from which there is no escape. It does not satisfy or take away your fear. It only creates a bigger one. So that's one reason why we might choose the unhealthy fears in life, is because I have believed that maybe sin can offer a solution to the fear that I'm feeling, but it is not a legitimate solution. This line of thinking went on for many, many years, as not only Cain wrestled with this, but in a moment we'll see that even the person in Jesus' day wrestled with this. Moses wrestled with fear. He was afraid of public speaking. He was afraid of leading. God had to work him through that, but Moses tended to turn towards unhealthy fears. David, King David, turned towards unhealthy fears. Even Abraham. You see this theme recurring throughout the Bible up to the point of Jesus' day, where actually some people were willing. Sorry, I have a little cold going on. Totally cracked my voice. So even in Jesus' day, there were some people that had almost given their life over to this unhealthy fear. They had found their identity or their solution in something that wasn't working. So Matthew chapter 9, we get this account of Jesus gathering his disciples and getting them together. And here comes another reason why we sometimes choose the unhealthy fears rather than a fear of God. So as Jesus went on from there, he saw a man named Matthew sitting at the tax collector's booth. And we don't need to go too much into Matthew's story, because actually Matthew is writing his own story, and he decides this is sufficient for you to know about him. Some people think that maybe Matthew was more of a toll collector type person, where to travel a certain way or to sell goods within a certain area, you had to get your permit from him first. Other people think maybe he sold blocks of tax collecting to people, where if you wanted to be a tax collector, you would go to Matthew, to his booth, and you would get the right to be a tax collector for a certain district. Either way, we know that Matthew was successful. He was good at what he did. And we also know that as a tax collector, he was not loved by his fellow people. And so one day, Jesus comes up to Matthew, his tax collector booth, not to pay a tax, but to pay a visit. And as Jesus approaches him, Jesus said, "Follow me." And Matthew got up and followed him. Now, what Matthew talks about in a very brief phrase can be expounded on if you look at what Mark and Luke also record about this event. Matthew's other name was Levi. And they emphasize that when Matthew was at his tax collector booth, you know, taking the taxes and keeping record of things, he didn't just step around the table to talk to Jesus and have a conversation, but actually what they emphasize is that Matthew left it behind. He left his life knowing that it was not the right way to live. An unhealthiness of just the way he was viewing people as opportunities to get more money. He left his old life behind and started to follow without even knowing the cost it might take. That's scary. Leaving behind what's familiar and pursuing something that's new. And that's kind of what we get from Matthew's account, is that it can be scary to leave what's familiar, even when what's familiar is not good. And this might be another reason why you and I, we might choose to hold on to the unhealthy fears, even when we know they're not healthy. There can be some fears that you have, that you've been dealing with in unhealthy ways. I think words like coping or self-medicating, ways to kind of get yourself through it without actually overcoming it. The thing about being a human, being a person, is that it's really easy for us to find what works, to distract us. And some common examples today are that when you start to feel the anxiety, you start to get afraid of something, we just bury ourselves in our phones, distract ourselves away from reality. Or to numb ourselves with food or with drink. To do things that maybe get our adrenaline going, but don't actually solve the problem. See, it can be so hard to leave what's familiar because to some degree, what's familiar has kind of been getting you through. But what's familiar, what's unhealthy, hasn't been giving you victory for overcoming the fear. So Matthew, though he might have been expecting a rebuke from this rabbi for the way he was treating his fellow Jews, instead, Matthew does the scary thing. He steps away from what's familiar, not knowing what was ahead, only knowing who he was following. The account goes on. This is really interesting because the next thing we see is that as Matthew is following Jesus, we don't get any of the details, but Matthew just jumps us right into this next part where they're having dinner. And so I'm wondering, did Matthew send out invitations? Was this like a week in planning or like what happened? Long story short, we don't know, but what we do know is that at some time, Jesus was having dinner at Matthew's house. And perhaps the reason Jesus picked Matthew is because of his connections. Many tax collectors and sinners came and ate with Jesus and his disciples. Have you ever thought about that for yourself? Well, what could Jesus do with a person like me? Well, sometimes he picks people who've been in maybe the wrong places because that's the kind of people he wants to reach. So Jesus has dinner with Matthew, knowing that dinner with Matthew will also mean dinner with tax collectors and people who had been labeled sinners, people who had been thrown out. And a quick question for you. Let's say that you're having dinner out in the public restaurant, lots of people around, and you've got a table with 6 chairs, but there's only 5 people with you. I'm sorry, 4 people. So there's one empty chair. I'm bad at math. We weren't trained for math. So there's one empty chair at your table. Just picture this. What kind of person would have to walk in the restaurant and sit down at the table for you to say, "I can't stay here anymore. I can't put up with this"? Just their presence means that you can't be there anymore. Don't answer out loud. But when you think about that, that's what the people in Jesus' day saw. They saw Jesus sitting with tax collectors and sinners, and anyone who considered themselves right with God would have nothing to do with these people because the kind of people you're with are the kind of people you are. So the Pharisees ask a question. When they saw this, they asked his disciples, "Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?" Implying that the kind of people you're with are the kind of people you become. And they didn't have to give an answer. I don't know if Jesus stopped the meal and stood up from a reclined position at the table, or maybe he was still reclined but just spoke up so everyone could hear. But Jesus responded with these words. On hearing this, Jesus said, "It is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick." And I'm glad I wasn't at that table with Jesus because that might have offended me. "Wait, what are you talking? Are you saying I'm sick, Jesus? Are you saying there's something wrong with me?" And truth be told, those who were at the table with Jesus already knew that they needed him. But it wasn't the healthy that needed him. It was the sick. It was the people who had been dealing with their fears in an unhealthy way. People who had been holding on to a fear and trying to manage it with sin in one form or another. Those people who had gone through all the different things people do, but still had not found a solution that would ultimately give them a release from this prison of fear. Those were the people that Jesus came to and for. So Jesus quotes this passage from, I think, Hosea chapter 6. He says, go and learn. And that would have been so offensive to the Pharisees who knew everything and actually taught the people about God. He says, there's some learning you need to do. Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. For I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners. God said, I desire mercy, not sacrifice. When you show your act of love or honor toward me, toward God, don't do it with sacrifices, but the best way to do it is by showing mercy to one another. Because when it comes to humanity, it's not like we have different levels, that some are righteous and some are not. We are all on the same level. Not. We are all in need of a doctor, someone who can come in and help us. And the cool thing with Jesus is that by saying this, he is implying that there is indeed hope for people like us. It's like a doctor who might hear about if you have a rare condition. A doctor might call you up and say, hey, I heard you have this. I'd like to see you sometime. You're not going to be offended by that because the implication is he can help or she can help. And so it is with Jesus. He says, I know what's in your heart. I know the fear that you have no solution for. I can heal you. And that's what he came to do. Jesus taught that there is hope for sinners. There's hope for people like me, people like you. One of the things that is so amazing about Jesus is that when he came to this earth, he did not do so as a judge to condemn people, but rather he came as a savior to rescue. And I'm trying to think, I can never do this fully, but I'm trying to think what his mission was like from his perspective. On the one hand, knowing that we were separated from God, not just by a little turnstile, but we were separated eternally from him with an obstacle of sin that we could not overcome. And on the other hand, knowing the righteousness of God and the holiness of God, and knowing that the true peace and joy that lay in that direction, was there a conflict for him? If so, it didn't last long. Because he was willing to even pursue death on a cross to bring us back to our Father. Which brings me to my last story here. So back in the summer of 2000, I think it was, we're old by now. Back in the summer of 2000, Pastor Dan and I took a little trip, 5-6 days up to Alaska. I started in Oklahoma from where I lived, where my parents were, drove up, was it Wisconsin, Minnesota? So we met up north, and then we traveled from there drove all the way up to Alaska. And it was an amazing summer working in a fish processing plant. I mean, that's just a glorious job. But then just with Alaska, all the sightseeing, all the traveling, and I don't know if you tell them stories about Alaska at all, but have them tell stories sometime. So it was an amazing summer, and there are certain memories of those 3 months that just stick out in my mind, and by the way, not all of them were good. We got into a little. We didn't like each other for a while. But there's one memory that is just ingrained in my mind, and it actually happened the day I left. So the summer of 2000 is when I turned 20 years old, and this was going to be the first summer I was away from home, and I was going to be a ways from home. And so I remember packing up. I'm so excited. I'm saying goodbye to my parents. Car is packed, ready to go. And I'm giving them a hug. And one of my parents, they're just, you know, tears are just flowing down. It's my mom. Tears are just flowing down her face. And I'm like, Mom, she's like making me sad. She's so teary. And I was like, hey, I'm going to miss you too. And, you know, I was like, it's no big deal. I'll be home in a few months and we'll talk, all this stuff. And so in my mind, it was sad, but not that sad. And now as a parent, I can see things from a different perspective. You see, when children are young, when they're still children, they are afraid to be far from mom and dad. They have a fear that keeps them close. But as children get older, they become not so childlike. They go to school. They have sleepovers. They have summer camps. They go to college. Some get married, they move out, they have a life of their own, and that's That's part of life, right? Celebrating that maturity into adulthood. But still, I remember the sorrow and the grief in my mom's eyes as I was saying goodbye, because it's not every day that your youngest stops being a teenager, and now he's not even going to be around to celebrate it. So that's part of life. But I can't imagine the grief from heaven when we forget that we will always be children of God. That while we mature in our faith, we never stop being his children. And the proper mindset for us to have is that we should be afraid to be far from him. So that whatever gets between us and him, we should be ready to jump over it, move through it, plow through it. That healthy fear of God is a fear of being far from him. And heaven was so grieved at our separation from sin that heaven sent a solution named Jesus. And that's what we needed. So as you think about this whole idea this week, as you know, we've got fears that will conflict in your life, and sometimes we choose the wrong one, sometimes because of sin, and sometimes because we're not willing to leave what's familiar. Maybe think about who you are. No matter how old you get, you'll always be a child of God. Let that be your greatest fear of being far from him. And 2 points of application. Number one, for some of you, a good application this week is to think about what are some unhealthy fears you've been holding on to, whether because it's just familiar or because you found a way to cope your way through it. And what would it look like to make God the greater fear in your life? For others of you, maybe a good application this week is to be more understanding of the people in your life. To understand that just because they're making bad decisions doesn't mean they're a bad person. Or as a parent, I have to apply this to myself. When my children act out, my default is to make them fear me more than whatever they're fearing. But my proper place is to understand the fear that's driving them. Let's talk about these friends. Let's talk about the fear and understand, just maybe the application, have an understanding of the people in your life or a curiosity. What are some of the fears that are driving them, and how might you be able to offer a better solution named Jesus? So it's been an honor to be with you today. You've got an amazing pastor. Keep listening to him. unless he's stupid, don't listen to him then. But what an amazing, amazing leader that you have, a heart from God, and it's an honor for me to be with you here today. I'll close with prayer, and then we'll join in the Lord's Prayer too. Dear Father in heaven, thank you so much for the gift of your son, Jesus. There are so many things in life that we can be afraid of, and we arrange our lives around those fears so as to minimize them. I pray this week that you would give us wisdom and insight into how we can not just work around those fears, but replace them with a healthy fear of you. Give us the faith to hold on to Jesus, who has made us your children, and always remind us of your perfect love displayed through him. I pray all these things in Jesus' name, as we also join together in the prayer that he taught. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our sins as we forgive those who sin against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For yours is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever and ever. Amen.